Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Earl Morris is with me today. Earl lives in Australia now, but he grew up in the United States in a tough neighbourhood. He joined the US military for a while and became a bodyguard after that to film stars like Kevin Costner, Clint Eastwood, and Nicolas Cage, and to diplomats and families as well. But he got thinking about the psychology of human predators, and so he did a degree in sociology to make him more aware of the way they think. In Australia, Earl works as a threat management consultant. He thinks it's important for people to be clear-sighted about potential threats to their safety so they can be freed from paralysing fear. And the work he loves most is teaching kids. Earl Morris wants to debunk the stranger danger myth, and we'll talk about that, and for parents to talk more to their kids about how to assert themselves. And part of his work is telling his own remarkable life story to kids, and I'm hoping he can do the same for us today. Hello, Earl.
How are you doing?
I'm extremely well. You were raised in Philadelphia, in the United States, in the 60s and 70s. Just paint a bit of a picture of your neighborhood. Take me there. Sort of paint a picture of that place.
Well, I grew up in a part of West Philadelphia, and like I was saying earlier, it was interesting when I went back. Very nice neighborhood. It was one of those neighborhoods where it was constantly kids on the street. Parents looked after each other's kids. I remember one time I got a spanking from one of the neighbors, and then I got a spanking from my dad when I got home for doing what I did.
So, what did you do, may I ask? Getting the tough questions already. Was this teaching stuff? Was it? What was this?
I had made a mistake and went and saw the movie Grease, and me and a couple—I can't believe I'm saying it—me and a couple of friends decided to dance Grease Lightning on a couple of people's cars.
You're kidding? You got a smack for that?
Yeah.
You should have been given a medal. I can't believe you get into trouble.
Yeah,
for that.
Well, I put a couple of dents in the guy's car too.
Were you Travolta or Kaniki in this? Were you?
I was Travolta.
Travolta.
Yeah, most kids are Travolta. Yeah. And you got that in your mental Rolodex now.
Yeah, I do now. I've got that picture in my head now. So that's the kind of neighborhood it was. People looked out for each other.
Yeah, though. Yeah.
And your father was such a big influence on your life,
as they
are in most of our lives. But he was a really big figure for you. Why did you look up to your dad so much?
It's kind of interesting. One of the things I loved about my dad was that he was on what I call the fringe of society. Most of the family members I had and friends and their family members, they were all very safe and secure in their world. And I know I will always hear stories from my father when he was in the Korean War. And as a police officer, I would hear many stories. And I was always fascinated that, you know, here's this guy, he was my dad, but there was another alter ego, almost, I guess, in my mind as a kid, almost like a Superman, because he would go into these areas and deal with things. And also being African-American at that time in history, he had to deal with a lot of difficulties. So I looked at him as the ultimate warrior in my eyes. And he was also a big history buff. So we talked a lot about warriors, and I was really heavy into martial arts. So everything just kind of meshed, and he was that icon.
The good guy. He's one of the good guys.
Yeah.
He was a policeman who were there many African Americans in the Philadelphia police force in those days?
There were. I wouldn't say a lot. He was a lieutenant, which was a little bit unheard of back then.
And quite a senior policeman then.
Yeah. And he kind of, you know, I heard a lot of the horror stories of what he had to go through, just racial issues and things like that in the 70s, early 60s, late 60s. And hearing those stories and seeing he always told me one time, the hardest thing for human beings is to learn to treat men as men. He said, we want to put things in little compartments to make it easier. And I didn't get it at the time. And he was trying to explain to me about racial issues, hatred and things like that. And he said, you know, you see things over and over again and you kind of want to put people, well, these people are like this and these people are like this. And he said, that's just how the human mind works. He said, hatred isn't a black or white thing. It's a human thing. And I never forgot that up until I got introduced to finally realize, I say that I realized I was African-American one day.
Did you realize it one day?
Yeah, I from a darker side. I didn't realize, you know, I always knew I was African-American, but I didn't realize the dark aspect. I always heard of it. You know, everyone's seen the TV show Roots. I always heard of it from my mother and father growing up in the 60s in the States. But I never really truly impacted me until one day coming from school, and that's when I finally understood what you
were talking
about.
What, some kid threw an unpleasant word at you?
Yeah, it was a group of us walking home from school one day. And just hanging out in the neighborhood that we were in was mostly an Italian neighborhood. And we get along quite well and everything. But at a certain time of the day, most African-Americans aren't in that neighborhood. And we were walking home from school, and a couple of young guys threw out a couple of words. And we, as kids and teenagers, we threw them back. They were teenagers, too. And, you know, next thing they turn around, they start screaming at us. We start running, and they're kind of, like, saying certain things. So we're laughing and running, and the next thing I hear was a gunshot. And saw an impact of a bullet hit the telephone pole. And then that's when the laughter stopped. And I finally realized that these guys were really trying to hurt us.
Who had the gun?
The kids.
How old was the kid?
Oh, they probably the same, roughly the same age as our, probably some of them a little bit older, probably anywhere from 16, 17 years old.
So that's what it's like, you know. You think you're a normal human being like everyone else, and then someone comes along one day and says, here, hold all this cultural baggage from 400 years.
Was it? Yeah, is that what it's like? Yeah, it was, and that's what I mean. It was kind of my wake-up call. And the unique thing about the experience, I also saw the duality of what my father was talking about, because we took refuge in this little corner store. They call them bodegas on the East Coast. And it was an old Italian guy there. And we could tell. We didn't realize it until we ran into the shop. And my best friend at the time, he was like, man, let's keep going because this guy's going to give us up to these guys. And I was like, no, just stay under the table. And the old Italian guy, he was like, somebody mess with you kids. Get back here. So we sat behind there. And next thing, we could hear the guys come in the shop. Did you see these two? What, blah, blah, blah. And the old guy had said that, you know, basically, do you know whose store this is? You don't bring this into my store. And I got the impression he was making a reference. I didn't realize who he was until years later, what he was talking about. But that old man basically made sure the kids wouldn't hurt us. And he actually called the cops and he said, you know, look, y'all stay here till the cops get here. One of the police officers, when they got there and we're taking our statement and everything, recognized my name. And I told him who my father was. He came and picked me up. And I remember I was sitting in a car, and I never, I didn't say anything. I was just sitting there. And I remember I said, the only thing I said to my dad was, you know, Dad, they shot at us, you know. And he was like, yep. And you know, one day I was going to have this conversation with you. And we kind of, for a little while, we kept it to ourselves. It was between me and my father, you know, the whole situation. We talked about it, and I saw that duality that he was talking about. You know, here are the kids that did what they did, but then you had this same nationality guy who was basically protecting us.
Do African-Americans call that the conversation, where your parents tell you how it is? Well, certainly back then. I know things are different now to some degree, but was that a common thing, the conversation where they say, this is how it is, if you're
African-American? I don't think there's a you know, predetermined time that you have the conversation. I think, and this is not just African-American, this is any nationality where you have very identifiable features.
Particularly for African-Americans, because there's slavery in that history
going way back,
isn't there? That's the difference, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's a long ripple, what I call a cultural ripple effect. But I think, yeah, most African-Americans do eventually have a little conversation about that.
This is how it is.
Yeah.
Can you recall back then how you saw the world? I know that's a big, incredibly general question, but you know, many people grow up feeling the world's a benevolent place, and it's and ultimately people are good, and we're going to be looked after. There's some bad stuff that happens, but ultimately we're going to be safe.
Yeah.
And there are others who grow up through circumstances where they think the world is fundamentally dangerous, and I have to get ready. Can you recall how you thought about the world back then?
For a while, and again, my father being the backdrop, I watched a lot of what was going on in his life.
Because he's bringing home the bad news all the time as a policeman, isn't he?
Yeah, he brings home the funny news. That was mostly. Really? Yeah, he used to tell us some really funny, outrageous stories, me and my brother, and we'd be cracking up about it. But then every now and then, I was really fascinated, so I would push him for that darker side. And it actually made me almost put him on a pedestal, because when I would hear some of the darker stories, I look at him and kind of go, I can't believe this man's seeing this on a daily basis, because he doesn't look like this when I'm talking to him, when he's joking with us, when he's doing all these goofy things in the house. So I was always fascinated how he had this, that duality, that balance.
So he could live in that world and survive in it and succeed in it.
But not be overcome and dominated by it.
When did you start to feel the need to arm yourself, if you like, physically through martial arts?
I think it was a couple of things. It was seeing what had happened with my father. My father got involved in a situation, it's a long story about that, where he was actually suspended for a while. And then later on, he was exonerated.
Tell me that story, because I think that's an important story.
He had gotten in... from what I recall when I was a kid, he had walked into a bar one night and stopped in there, and some police officers were having someone against the wall checking him out. Another kid jumped him when he announced he was a police officer. During the scuffle, the kid took my father's firearm and tried to shoot him. My dad, in the struggle, the kid got shot and it paralyzed him. Later on, it was said that he never announced he was a police officer. So it was a big stigma about this, and they couldn't find his badge. They later apparently found out that he was telling the truth, everything was fine, but that was several years later. And that's when my life kind of started taking a little darker turn.
How did that suspension then affect your father, given that...
It devastated him. Yeah. It truly devastated him. I remember very, very good moments with my dad, but then at a certain point, they got very dark. Not a lot of law enforcement people, but in that type of world, a lot of times you end up consuming alcohol to try to deal with things. And he was great when he wasn't drinking. As soon as he started drinking, he changed. There was a lot of anger in him. And I used to, at the time, being a kid, a lot of times you're not equipped. I think kids, a lot of times we... And even teenagers, we see the world in black and white, you this or that. It's not till we get a little bit older and start experiencing things in the world that we kind of go, okay, the world can sometimes be shades of gray. And it wasn't until years later that I actually finally came to a forgiveness for my father. And I still loved him. To this day, he's still that, you know, inner voice that tells me, you know, keep your head straight, you know, and things like that.
You were a kind of, I think you described yourself as a teenager as a jock nerd, which is really interesting. I didn't think you were allowed to be a member of both clubs.
Yeah, I consider myself a jock nerd because a lot of times to escape some of the stress when I come home from school and I knew that, you know, he might have a drink that night or whatever, I would go to the library. And the library was kind of a sanctuary for me.
And you're a history buff already, too.
Yeah. I was really fascinated. At a young age, I was always fascinated why people did what they did. And I think that not only his what was happening with him was making me question why did he react this way? Why did, you know, the human mind does this? So I was always fascinated with that. And when I would go to the library, it was like the world was at my fingertips, and I was always inquiring about things. I was really fascinated with, I wanted to be an astronaut, so I was really fascinated with space, and then later on it turned from that to Asian philosophy, and then that's where my uncle, who had a karate studio, was my first instructor, and I just got totally fascinated with the martial arts. So not just the physicalness of it, like most young people would mostly be the physical attraction. It was that too, but it was the duality. Again, it came up in my face again that, again, life wasn't black or white. It was just balance, just harmony that worked. And it wasn't until one of my instructors years later, he had said that you got to learn how to master the warrior priest, he used to call it. And I was like, what do you mean by that? He said, well, you look at most Japanese artwork in museums. Some of the most beautiful artwork was done by some of the most ferocious samurai warriors. And they understood that there has to be a balance between a warrior and a priest, that there has to be another counter side to kind of balance that other side out.
The man of action and the man of thought.
Yeah.
The warrior with moral authority or moral insight.
And I got that from my father because he was a very intelligent man. He used to we used to say he had like a photographic memory. He was extremely intelligent. And he used to do this thing with me and one of my friends. He would, we were in, get ready to go to school, and we were asking, the kids thought it was really cool. They were asking to look at something on television, and they'd go, that. And then they would turn it off, and he would look at it, and he would draw exactly what he just saw on TV. And so he was just really unique. And that's what I mean, that duality always kind of pulled me towards, and I guess I saw it in him, that duality, and then that's what pulled me towards the martial arts, was the duality.
We men are can be so brittle, can't we? Your dad, you know, was quite brittle, as it turned out. What did you think from that? Did you think, I won't be that brittle? I will be this warrior priest, but if I can, I will strive for that, but I won't. Did you draw some conclusions?
I also understood human frailty. I had a certain insight into... In Asian culture, they have a saying that the strongest branch breaks very easily, but the one that survives in a storm is the one that's supple, that kind of goes back and forth with the storm and can deal with it. So I learned at a young age that that there's power in flexibility and adaptability. I actually teach that in one of my things where I tell people that in the leadership course, that the survival of the fittest, what does that mean to you? And most people go, oh, the fastest or strongest survive. And I was like, no, they don't. The one who survives is the most adaptable. And that's, again, that duality, that, you know, that blending.
My guest in conversation is former bodyguard Earl Morris, who grew up in Philadelphia. He now lives in Australia, where he works as a threat management consultant. And the work Earl loves most is teaching kids. And more about that a little bit later. You then got yourself into shape. You were learning in the library, and this thing happened to your dad. And you said your father was eventually exonerated, though, wasn't he?
Yeah.
This. And did that give him some relief, or was he just a bit too banged around?
I think he was too banged around. I also think, and I experienced this to some degree. I was talking to a friend recently about this. There's a certain thing that goes through women and men who live on what I call the warrior edge, emergency responders, things, those fields of endeavor where you are challenged to be of service to others. And when you no longer have that, that intensity or whatever, it you kind of get lost and you don't know where to go. You don't know where you fit in because that lifestyle is so intense. You know, you have to be switched on all the time. And again, that was the thing that made me kind of put my father on the pedestal, that I always kind of saw that, you know, he could go out, do battle with dragons and stuff, and then come home and still, you know, be that guy, that funny guy.
It's kind of natural that you would have joined the U.S. military. Mm. I know you don't like to talk about that much, but what can you tell me about your time in the U.S. military? You need to be discreet, don't you?
I did some time in the military police and then later on in the U.S. Special Operations. It was, again, my father's influence a little bit that made me go there. I used to always hear people, we used to call them chairborne rangers. People who kind of sit on the sidelines of life and they watch television and the media and they speculate and throw out the world is this way, the world is that way. And I had always known at a young age that there's always another side to what we see on television and everything. And that coupled with the whole warrior aspect, I knew I wanted to go into the military. I knew I wasn't going to be a career soldier. My ideal of my life was to go into the military, come out, be a police officer. I wasn't planning on getting married because I seen the impact it had on my mother.
The worry,
the father's been injured and seeing the reaction to that. And I kind of was envisioning myself to be like Martin Riggs.
From Lethal Weapon?
Yeah, like I was just going to have a dog, drink beer, chase bad guys.
In the caravan.
Yeah, you know. And when I was in high school, and I'd probably say right around the time, right when I finally got out of the military, I was kind of lost. I was wondering, okay, what's the next intense thing that I can do? And that's where I was kind of for a little while lost, and I was helping a friend out with youth at risk, youth, and finally kind of got a foothold. And then it wasn't until one day my father had called me and told me about somebody, Private Eye in New York, had offered him a gig to do protection work. And my dad was like, "Oh, I'm retired. I don't do all that." But my son, and I kind of talked to him about it and said, "Well, yeah, I'll do it." And I had the training that I received in the military for doing it, and that was my first civilian bodyguard job.
Ah, but there's so much more to a bodyguard's work than just protection,
yeah.
Isn't there?
Yeah.
You've got to be a diplomat too, don't you?
Yes.
I mean, it's all with your words and posture and look, really, much more than... You've got to have that physical... Tell me a bit about what... I'm telling you what the job requires. You should tell me what the job requires instead, I think. But tell me about about the work of the bodyguard, how you came to understand the nature of that work for important people.
It was the training. I had realized through military training how planning is everything. They have the five Ps they always talk about in the military. And that that had been so ingrained in my psyche. When I got out and finding out what the real protective world was, when I went through training in the military and everything, that's when I realized that, okay, this might be an area I want to go into. And most people see where they see the bodyguard, and they see – most people have this illusion that a bodyguard has to be muscle-bound guy, martial art expert and everything. I know when I first got here to Australia, I was lecturing to bodyguards, and some of them had a lot of martial art capabilities. And I would tell the guys, I say, look, I have martial art background as well. Don't mean any disrespect by this, but I'd never seen a martial artist block an AK-47 round. And the guys sit there and they laugh and look at me for a minute. And then they go, oh, I get what you're trying to say. So I was trying to stress to the guys, what keeps you alive is your planning and your risk assessment beforehand. That's what keeps you alive. And I think the biggest compliment I got from guys who I've trained was that they didn't realize how cerebral the field was, mental.
Isn't the first law of, you know, the Art of War by Sun Tzu that, you know, the best way to do it is to win without even fighting?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? So don't put you in a situation where you need to fight.
And that's the ultimate thing. A lot of people, I think, you know, the movies and everything, they like the drama and everything. But the primary goal of a protector is to keep your principal out of danger. Historically, most bodyguards don't survive a lethal encounter if it's done really properly. So that's why threat assessments and being knowledgeable and client management is one of the things I got beat over the head with when I went through a civilian protection school. That was one thing. I was like a maverick, never leave your wingman. I never forgot one mistake I made in a course that I went through, and I never forgot that, how important planning is and how detailed it has to be. A lot of people don't realize it.
What was your mistake?
I had forgot a simple thing of how to manage my client properly.
Because clients want to do stupid things sometimes?
Yeah, there's an education process for some. I've protected some people who've used to having security, and they kind of go, okay, this is what I want to do. Okay, you guys tell me how I can do it. And then you have some clients who have no clue, and you have now this intrusion into their lives. And there's a dance that you have to do, an education process that you have. Most people, ideal of a bodyguard, is just big martial arts guy, and the average, actually, that's the contrary. I always tell guys, you know, you look at the U.S. Secret Service. These guys aren't huge. They're not linebackers, or the federal police, Australian federal police. A lot of them are normal stature people, because it isn't necessarily the hard skills that keeps their principal out of danger. It's the soft skills that you don't see.
Tell me about your first client, what you can tell me about that person.
I can tell you kind of briefly a little bit about them. The first one was through my father, and that was involving a gentleman, a gay activist in New York City. He had already been put in a hospital through a domestic terrorism group. I won't say any names wrong because they're still active, but it was a domestic terrorist group in the United States, and they had already put him in the hospital, nearly killed him. Once he got out, he decided to relocate, get rid of his businesses in New York, and just basically move on with his life somewhere else. In that interim, the person that hired me, we were basically keeping an eye on them till they packed up everything and got everything going. Everything was great for about a month. And then about a month and 2 weeks later, we actually had an attempt to try to get at him.
Can you tell me what form that attempt took?
It took baseball bats in that form, where guys were getting ready to come at him with a baseball bat, and didn't realize myself and a couple other people who were planted around this individual. And we were able to see it before it was right on top of us. Again, this is where that pre-planning, recognizing things before it's right on top of you. We were able to get the client out of there, and I end up having to stand there by myself while the rest of the team is going to deal with the threat. And fortunately, in New York City, there are police officers everywhere. So
did they scarp it once they saw that that your client had you in place for him there?
At first, they didn't know what to deal with. They didn't know what was going on because they couldn't really – they could peg one of us, one or two of us as protectors, but they did not count on the other ones that we had in place.
I love those moments of surprise.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
My guest today is a fascinating man, former bodyguard Earl Morris, as you can maybe be able to tell. Earl grew up in the United States. He now lives in Australia, where he works as a threat management consultant. So acting as a bodyguard, you also, I don't know if you were doing it at this time or had done a degree. You went to university, yeah. Earl, yeah. And you did a degree in behavioral science and sociology. Why? Mm-hmm. Tell me why you wanted to do that in particular.
Well, I'm afraid to admit this, but originally when I first was getting ready to get my degree, because I told you I was kind of a jock nerd, it was originally parapsychology I was actually studying.
Get out of town. What, like spooky stuff?
Yeah, my dad kept teasing me, called me a Ghostbuster. And he was like, how are you going to get a job as a Ghostbuster? And that's when I was like, yeah, you got a good point. So, but again, I was always, the psychology thing was what I was fascinated with.
Parapsychology? You have just blown my mind. I was not expecting you to say that. So you did, what, you did a bit of that and then got into
I did like maybe two classes and, right. Physics and quantum physics and stuff like that, and then moved on, then finally got serious about what I wanted to do, and that's when I started studying psychology because, again, I was always fascinated why people did what they did. I knew women who were being battered in domestic situations, and I never could understand why they just don't leave. Everyone always, all their friends, family's like, oh, just leave. And it wasn't until, it was actually two experiences I had in the military watching the power of fear, how you can instill fear, a small group can instill fear on a mass group and keep them in line just using fear. And it wasn't until I had that experience and then coupled with my uni degree, learning about psychology and how the human mind works, that I finally understood people who are in domestic situations and how they are just paralyzed with fear.
Often in these groups you're talking about, the ones that are creating that kind of crippling fear, there's a psychopath, not necessarily a psycho killer, but a person with psychopathic tendencies. Did you study that? And were you interested in the mind of the psychopath?
Yeah. I started researching more and more, and I got to learn some things from some of the FBI profilers, go to some of their seminars and courses. But I learned about those guys, but the ones who really fascinated me weren't necessarily the serial killers. It was really the everyday person of what they go through and why and the power of fear and how people become victims. That's basically, in a nutshell, that's where I was fascinated with, why people become victims. And I began to notice that victimology is a state of mind, not a state of being. And I was always fascinated with that state of mind, how to change that state of mind in people.
So you're more interested in the victim of this than the perpetrator or both?
Sorry?
I'm more interested in the victim of this kind of the victim of the fear rather than the perpetrator.
Yeah, I pretty much understood the perpetrators. because, and this is something I even, my father, I remember one time saying it, but I also learned it from a gentleman named Gavin DeBecker. And one of his things was that protectors and predators are kind of cut from the same cloth. At some juncture in their life, they take a different direction. And I used to, I remember watching my father and walk into a bar one time. And whenever he walked into a bar, he had this way he would scan the crowd. And when he scanned it, and he would always sit a particular way where he could see everyone. And I remember when I got a little bit older and I go to, you know, bars, I was in the military, and I noticed the guys who are the, you know, we call it peacocking. You know, they have the tats on, they look, and they're loud and everything. We used to have a saying in intelligence that normally the loudest guy in the room is sometimes the weakest. We call it peacocking. And I was always fascinated how they do the same thing. They scan the room the same way. And I remember when I was going through psychology courses and stuff, and when I was doing my experience with the military and doing protective work and learning things from some of the FBI profilers, the protectors and predators were very similar. Protectors were predators, but predators are predators. And that's where I started realizing that there was a certain state of mind. The best way I can describe the protector-predator relationship is a article that Colonel Grossman, David Grossman, had wrote called Sheep, Wolves, and Sheep Dogs. And he kind of explains the whole process of law enforcement and how law enforcement are those sheepdogs that are keeping predators at bay.
And must not become wolves.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And he even talks about that, sheepdogs who become wolves and how they have to be removed out of society and things like that. But
do you think you've got to, do you think after all your experience now, you can do that thing and recognize, can you kind of smell the wolves, if you
yeah.
like?
And that's yeah. what I think when I'm trying to explain, that's what I noticed. There's a certain things. Predators are very adept at recognizing prey, recognizing victims, recognizing alleged or perceived weakness. And protectors are very good at recognizing predators. I remember when I was there was an employer that I was working for here at one time, and I was actually starting to teach my guys the psychology of recognizing aggression before the person acts out the aggression. And a couple of times we had guys who were come into the shop, and I remember one day a gentleman came in, and he had this look on his face, and all my guys were all up in the uproar. They had thought he was like, you know, like a bikey guy or something like that. And I was looking at him for a while, and then finally I said, they called me downstairs, and I started talking to him, and he said, you know, that guy over there and stuff. I said, he's either a police officer or he's a soldier, and he's not your typical run-of-the-mill soldier. And so we had a bet going on because the guys always were kind of fascinated with me doing this whole behavioral thing. And it wasn't until one of the salespeople had came over and said, oh, Earl, I would love to introduce you to my client. He just got back from Iraq, and he's a former SAS guy. And my guys were like, I was like, pay up, you know, and they were like, how in the world, you know, did you recognize that? And I said, there's a certain behavior, just like bad guys. A lot of times they say they can tell a cop a mile away. Cops can also tell predators a mile away. And that has always been my fascination. How could I teach everyday people how to recognize that, how to develop that themselves?
You've acted as bodyguard for many major Hollywood stars, like I mentioned Clint Eastwood and Kevin Costner and, mm-hmm. and others as well. And you can't talk about that, of course. But the thing about celebrities is that when they're in the street, people get a bit silly around them.
Yeah.
People who normally carry themselves with the utmost dignity, something go, ah, like that. There's a weird thing. Is part of your job as a bodyguard to a major celebrity to manage that?
Yeah.
How do you do it?
You manage. I remember I was telling somebody recently that a lot of people are shocked that not only does a bodyguard manage the physical safety of their principal, they have to also manage their dignity, especially when you're dealing with a high-profile client. You know, Janet Jackson or whoever walking out on stage and someone throws a banana peel in there, and you know, or have some other malfunction occur on stage or whatever. Could be just as damaging to their, you know, their reputation as if someone jumped up and threw something at her.
Is the bodyguard's job to get on stage and cover up the breast again?
Exactly. Yeah. I've had. I didn't
breast
do it.
Tackle Justin Timberlake.
I didn't protect a whole lot of celebrities, but I have a couple of guys who they specialize in celebrities. And some of the things that they have to protect their dignity from is amazing.
Errol, tell me about your wife and what did she make of what you were doing at the time?
At first I wasn't too sure. My wife's actually from Ireland.
From the north of Ireland?
No, south. Yeah. And it was interesting when we hadn't met. I didn't do very well with girlfriends at times because sometimes I would just take off and go work or whatever and stuff. And my wife was awesome. She, I think there was a little bit of a, there was one particular time I know she was really upset at me. And it was, it actually kind of showed the life where all of a sudden at a whim I was picked up and gone somewhere and stuff. And I remember one time, I think she started noticing the planning, because at first, I know a lot of her friends, I think, asked her, you know, do you ever get worried? And I think when she started seeing the planning that was involved, that it isn't just, you know, just one guy standing up there waiting for somebody to do something and that's it. When she started seeing the type of levels of security that we put around the person and all the planning and detail, I think that's when she started getting a little bit more comfortable with it, like, okay, you know. And I also think she was kind of fascinated with the psychology of it as well.
How did you feel about you having a gun all the time on you?
I don't know. I remember when she first came to Texas, she was kind of fascinated seeing police officers with guns in the States because she wasn't used to seeing that. But I remember one time when she finally asked me about learning to shoot, and I just told her, I was like, oh, I'm surprised. And she said, no, I want you to teach me. And I was like, okay, because I never pushed that on her because a firearm is just strictly like a carpenter uses a hammer. For my line of work, it was just a tool. And that's it. There's no ego attached and things like that. And I've trained security and law enforcement people and civilians as well. And it was the fascinating thing with training civilians in the States was that the guys, you had to deal with the egos. Women tend to be really good shots, not because women are naturally better shots. Number one, they don't have the ego. They will get professional training. And they tend to listen to what you say, and they don't get wrapped up in the whole testosterone part of it, because shooting is a skill, just like anything else. Anyone can learn it.
Yeah, and it's deeply exciting, too. I've only ever fired a gun once in my life, and it was a guilty pleasure. It was sort of went, that felt much better than it ought to have.
Yeah, guys kind of do the Tim the Two-Man Tail.
And that's real silly. I mean, but it's human, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
If I had just hired you as my first bodyguard, what would you tell me as your client, if you're not giving away too many professional secrets?
No. Well, you kind of start out on learning a little bit about your lifestyle. Once I kind of get a little idea of your lifestyle, then I kind of introduce you to what I'm bringing into your lifestyle. Kind of walk you through like a daily activity of what we're going to be doing. There are some things that you may have to do a little bit differently. I think the biggest thing with being a really good protector for a client is getting that relationship where they will share information with you. Even the information, a lot of times you get information that even their family members don't know, because after a while they look at you as that confidant because you don't judge, you don't do anything. You just take on board that information, and that information actually helps you better protect them. So to get
so
to that level.
It's like a psychiatrist relationship with the client.
Yeah, very, very much so.
And
yeah.
Do your clients then start unburdening themselves of all kinds of stuff to you?
Yeah.
So you're a father confessor to your clients?
You're a little bit of everything. A lot of times they'll confide in a lot of things they won't even confide in their family. And that's where that professionalism is a little bit different, I notice. I've seen bodyguards who've written books, and they pretty much divulged information. I've had clients who actually did a raw deal on me, didn't pay me or whatever, and to this day I will not divulge any of their information. That's a personal thing with me. I know many other guys and women who are the same way, and fortunately I've been able to partner with a lot of those type-minded individuals, but then you have others who take that information and use it.
My guest in conversation, if you've just joined us, is former bodyguard Earl Morris, who now advises on security to all kinds of people. And he lives in Australia now. What brought you to Australia? Tell me about coming here. The choice to come to Australia.
Lifestyle.
Lifestyle.
I think it was once we had kids, my wife and I kind of traveled a lot around the U.S. and other places. And we were just kind of like, got to the point it was either going to be Ireland or Australia. And we was like, And then my brother-in-law and them, when they heard that we were thinking about going to Ireland, they were like, no, come to Australia. And we came to visit one time and loved it. And I'd love the people. It reminded me very much. I spent a lot of my time in Texas, although I'm from the East Coast. And the friendliness, the warmth, the attitude towards friendship and family was one of the things that kind of appealed to us. So we just said, okay, let's just pack up the bags and give it a go, and we did.
Did Australia's multiculturalism appeal to you as well? The fact that, there's people here from all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, I see the same thing in the States to probably a larger degree, because I could be talking to anybody, especially on the East Coast of the United States.
How close to the surface are your own emotions when you're looking after someone? I mean, you have to manage that, don't you?
Yeah, you. It's very clinical. I know a lot of guys. They will, like one of the guys who was my mentor. He would end up looking after people for sometimes like a year or two, but he would not go beyond like a 2-year period because he says he's getting too close to him. He would actually rotate out, and I remember him teaching me that. That was one of the things that I learned when I was saying one of those mistakes that I made. It was a mistake. Nothing happened or anything. But one of the things that if you get too close, it gets a lot difficult to protect them because you start more concerning about their feelings sometimes needs to be overrode with you protecting them. And sometimes that can kind of, you know, you probably want, oh, I know they don't want to do this, but you have to tell them that they have to do this. So that's where you do, there's a discipline that you have to manage. And that's where a lot of people don't realize. They just think, you know, big guy, martial arts, but they don't realize the discipline, the training is extremely important because it's not natural for a person to step into harm's way when danger is right there. Your natural instinct is self-preservation. It's through that repetitive conditioning of training where you start learning to intervene into the middle of danger to protect the principle that you're working for.
In Australia, you've looked after people who are being stalked, who are being preyed upon by stalkers. How do you go about that? Is it preferable sometimes to actually bring upon some confrontation with the stalker so they can effectively bounce off you and then go away forever, if you know what I mean?
No, stalking situations are extremely tricky because there's a lot. I know in the U.S., for a while, there weren't a lot of laws in place, legislation to back up civilians when they had to try to intervene or put certain measures in place. Now there are tons of laws that now help you manage stalking. A lot of times, like right now, I give advice on how to manage it to workplaces and things like that. Most typical thing that I started noticing, most people just immediately, okay, well, let me call up a security company. But they don't realize that stalking a lot of times is extremely emotional. And there again, that calls in psychology, not necessarily a heavy-handed, you know, security thing. That actually might escalate it. I had one issue in the U.S. where the person was advised to get a restraining order, is what they call them in the States. And a lot of the experts in the field nowadays would advise people to kind of hold up before immediately getting a restraining order. The restraining order works very well in court, but it doesn't always hold, physically stop that person from committing some act or whatever. So a lot of times we assess each situation to see where the aggression is, basically on like a slide scale.
Will you try and initiate a conversation with the stalker?
Not necessarily. Every situation is a little bit different. Most of the time they're initiating it, so I don't really have to initiate anything. I'll gather information and kind of assess where they are, what the situation is, and then we start trying to take appropriate actions to what we call the aggression continuum, try to bring that person down the continuum or keep it at a certain level. What makes it so extremely tricky is that you can't control the emotions or the psychosis that this other person has.
No, he might go out and have a bad day somewhere that's got nothing to do with you. And,
So the thing is, first is to kind of assess, okay, what is the motivation for this? And then from there, we can start working up a profile and figuring out how we best can manage this person. Some, most cases, a lot of time, we still have to have that security presence, keep an eye on that person while they're going to the workplace or whatever. But a lot of people tend to, nowadays, they are beginning to realize that you have to have some type of behavioral advice involved. It isn't just a matter of hiring a security guard and saying, okay, you stand at the door. And because some people don't even know who their stalker is, especially now with the advent of Facebook, all the social media things. Now you have cyber stalking. And in cyber stalking, it goes from the cyber world to the real world. And a lot of today, a lot of people don't really, the bandage is, let's hire a security guard. Well, a security guard can only manage that when it gets to a reactionary level, where that person's now walking up to your doorstep. But they can't manage it when that person's somewhere online. Thinking online or whatever.
Well, how did you fall into the role of teaching parents about child predators?
It was actually my wife had a lot to do with it. For years, she's always been like, you know, you should, if you could just get that stuff out of your head and package it and talk to people about it. And it was actually one incident that I gave some advice to some people about someone in their neighborhood. And kind of it sounded like the person was grooming their daughter.
What does that mean?
Basically, some predators, I kind of put, just for the simplicity of it, power predators are typical, the predators that a lot of people think is prevalent, the abduction, you know, where they drive up in the car and grab a child into a car. That's not necessarily true. I think in Australia, I could be a little bit off with the figures, but I think 95% are family and friends.
Known to the family.
Yeah. So that calls into the category what we call persuasive predators. That's a predator that tends to have to cultivate a relationship with the child. That type of predator is where a lot of it is on the child's empowerment to be able to do things. And in this particular situation, this guy was grooming this lady's daughter. And I could hear it a little bit, kind of gave a couple of little suggestions, and then I didn't find out about it until months later that it was legit, the guy was grooming her. And when I had mentioned, the lady at the time had said, well, she always talked to her daughter about strangers, and I was like, it's not the stranger. I said, that's where the danger comes into play. I said, a lot of people always running around going stranger danger.
Yeah, you'd think that was the case if you read the papers, though, wouldn't you? And watch news media all the time. That it was all stranger danger, wasn't it? But the stats tell us else otherwise. Don't
exactly,
they?
Exactly. It's mostly friends or family, someone that's known to the child. So that's where we teach a lot of how to empower children, how to recognize predatory behavior.
Do you find parents are unwilling to have that conversation with kids?
When I first started, I was kind of taking a look. I was watching, it was actually interesting. I was watching a TV ad, and my wife and I, we could not find out. We were almost offering classes for free and still could not get to fill the seats. And we were like, all right, what is it going on here? And it wasn't one night I was sitting up and we were watching television, and I saw this ad for starvation and poverty in Africa. You know, we're flicking channels, and then we just flick right over it, which is what most people do. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me, I remember something that it was actually something I heard Tony Robbins had said one time, that people are motivated by pain and pleasure. And anything that's too painful will back away from it. So I started taking a look at it, and I started realizing that maybe instead of focusing on the scariness of it, we need to get parents to focus on the empowerment of it. That the only reason why a lot of this is continuing to happen is because we don't want to talk about it. We teach children how to cross the street. We teach them, you know, don't touch this on the stove. But whenever it comes to talking about a human being harming you or anything like that or touching you in the wrong way, we shy away from it. Most of it is the parents, our own fears. That's why we don't want to talk about it.
So how do you talk to kids about this directly in ways they understand without terrifying them about the world?
Sooner or later, if you ask most parents, at some point in time, a child has brought up something about it. I know with our own children, we actually, my son has brought it up, my daughter has brought up certain things, and I kind of go, well, what do you think of that? One of the things that I suggest the parents do as well is try to gradually start building your child's confidence to socially interact with people. Because once they can start speaking for themselves, I remember I was walking with my son one day, and that's when it dawned on me, coming out of the video shop, and we were getting right across the street. I had started talking to the lady at the video shop. My son kept walking, and a car almost hit him. And I, like, yelled at him, screamed at him. He jumped back on the curb. And I was like, Sinker, what are you doing? He was like, well, I thought it was okay because you're always, like, standing right there. He was so used to me being there all the time that he just switched off. And that's when
it dawned on me. What you're talking about. Yeah. I completely am there. I know exactly what you mean. And then you realize you've got to teach kids to handle that situation themselves.
You got to teach them. And the only way you can really do that is instead of not talking to strangers, you actually have to, in a way, encourage them to talk to strangers.
We only got a couple of minutes left, but part of the dialogue we have about this, there's a lot of concern, and I worry about this too, that men get demonized at the end of this. You know, both guys, and it's all men that are these bad people, and men, you don't really know who they are. Yeah. How do you put all that in context? That's not easy, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, even for myself, I know it's not. Like, I'm very affectionate with my kids. And I know there's a lot of guys, I've had guys like, you know, they're affectionate with their kids, but they go to a park and they're with their kids, you know, and their son makes a, you know, kicks the soccer ball the right way. And he goes, yeah, and gives them a hug. Right? And I heard a couple of dads kind of go, they get these looks from some moms in the park.
I know,
and they kind of go
off.
Like,
I know.
You know, and they're almost to the point like they're afraid to hug their kids. But it's just one of those things that unfortunately, because it's so much fear around the subject, and that's my ultimate goal, again, is coming back to that fear. That fear is what's putting everyone in danger. Once you understand fire and you learn the mechanics of it, when you're a kid, the fear goes away. It's the same thing with child protection and things like that. When you learn the mechanics of it, the fear goes away and you can better protect your child and they can better protect themselves.
It's been great talking to you today, Earl. You're a fascinating guy. And I really love this conversation with you. You're a fascinating man. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.